Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. Thank you for coming out in this dreadful weather. I thought in February we counted flowers, not snowballs, but anyway, there it is. So tonight we have an opportunity to talk about the play that you're about to see. My name's Linda Hardy. I've directed Twelfth Night, and this is my colleague, Pat Haywood, who has done the costume design. And we are hoping a third colleague will show up very shortly, who's our associate director, and he's done the music, or at least composed some of the tunes for Mr. Shakespeare's beautiful songs. So we thought you might like to know about our process and how we came to do what it is we're doing with Mr. Shakespeare. And so I'll start by saying, at the Phoenix Theatre, in the month of January, February, it's a very compressed time. So doing a big show with 22 actors means that per actor, you've got a relatively small costume budget. And even more condensed and compressed is the time in which you have to put the set together and the costumes, because we've got another show coming down the pike, right? So of necessity, the director is more or less constrained, if we're going to do Mr. Shakespeare at all, to do it in a modern period. And that's that. Ha! So, then you say to yourself, right, let's serve the play first. So what is the play about? And then, how do we marry it or match it to an era or a time that seems to fit or gel? Well, first of all, the play was a very special event, as I said a little bit about it in my notes in the program. It was commissioned by Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth I herself, for her 12th night celebration in 1600. And by the old calendar, it was still the old year on January 6th. It hadn't turned yet. It was a leap year, and she was entertaining a distant cousin, the Duke Orsino, from what is now modern Tuscany. And she wanted something very special. He was the greatest nobleman of his day, quote unquote, a lad in his early 20s, just married, and someone whom she wanted to make a bridge to do some fence mending with the Pope. So what does she do? She entertains him royally, and she asks the greatest playwright of her day to write something up for her, and she gives him 10 days to do it in. Shakespeare was at the height of his powers, 35 years old, and he whips up a confection, which he calls Twelfth Night, which was the night that it was being done for, or What You Will. A lovely pun on his own name, and Her Majesty's commission, right? So first of all, she wanted something full of music, song. The English were famous for their music and their dancing. Elizabeth was herself famous for her light feet, and she danced that night, and she hadn't danced in some time. She was well up in her late 60s. She danced for Orsino that night, right? She had a great singer at court, and she wanted a play that would feature him. She wanted a play that focused on love, partly because he'd just gotten married, and she hadn't been able to go to the wedding, so this was the best she could offer. And also because it was a special kind of celebration, insofar as it was a leap year, and the ladies were in the ascendant. Now, some of you know about leap year and Sadie Hawkins and all of that. I confess that some of the younger set didn't know about what women can do in a leap year and that they have the prerogative to propose. So that too is in the play. The ladies are very powerful and they come to the fore. And Olivia herself, who we know is a copy of the young Elizabeth, and Olivia means the woman who wears the olive branch, the branch of peace. And of course, Elizabeth was known as the great peacemaker of England, right? So she is Olivia. It was also Twelfth Night, the Saturnalia, which meant that you could turn everything upside down and you could ape your betters and you could make fun of people who'd gotten out of line during the year. So at court, this was a great opportunity. And Elizabeth never missed the opportunity to pull certain people back into line. Now, she had a controller. That's the man who was in charge of all the finances. Sir William Knowles. He was in his 50s and married, and he had been writing love letters to one of her young, beautiful ladies-in-waiting, Mary Fitton, Mistress Maul. So he ends up being hazed in the play, and the character whose name is Malvolio, which means I want Maul, gets quite a hazing. And so that was there too, this irreverence for the people in high places when they get a little out of line, the ascendance of the women, and fabulous music. Okay, and how to serve that. And then, of course, to top it all off, maybe because Shakespeare had twins himself, and he wrote another play with twins in it, there are twins in Twelfth Night. So the girl I was looking at for Viola has waist-length hair. And she said to me, oh, Linda, you won't cut my hair, will you? I thought, oh, bloody hell. So, how do you take those things? Keep the spirit of it and find an era. Well, I thought about music. I thought about the Beatles. 1970 was where I was at. And I thought about the trip to India and the visit to the guru, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, right? Remember that? And they all trooped off and George Harrison became a dedicated follower. So I thought, right, we'll have her go to Orsino's court as a swami. We'll wrap her hair up in a turban. And her brother can find his outfit maybe on a barrow dealer's cart. So that's where it began. The idea of setting it in the 1970s when there was a Hare Krishna around every corner. When the music was fantastic, there was a great irreverence for authority, and women were feeling their own. They were becoming empowered. They were sexy, those girls. After all, the pill had been out for some time, and they were thinking, you know, I've got power. I could go after my man. I don't have to be a shrinking violet anymore. So as I said, the women in Twelfth Night are not shrinking violets by any means. So that's where Ms. Haywood comes in. We started to get together and look at the spectrum of how we might create the 1970s and what we might do with these characters and how we might costume them and what might work. So at this point, I will turn it over to Kat, and she can explain her process. And we've got some of the results up there. We haven't shown you them all because we want to surprise you with some of it. We're not going to tell you what Malvolio is wearing when he gets all dressed up for his lady. But it was something Mick Jagger wore once.
Yes. It's really outrageous.
It's very outrageous, but that's as far as we're going to go. So, Kat?
Right, to whet your appetite for the visual feast we're going to see tonight. So, I'm very glad that Linda hit upon how appropriate 1970 is for this play. It's a time of color. It's a time of vibrancy, of love, of wonderful music. I just wish I'd been alive back then. I do mean that quite seriously because the audience will have. And so as a designer, one always asks the question of, okay, how are you going to be authentic to that time period to capture what it really was like back then and still have a dramatic version of the play to really portray character? Because one can get really mired in reality and tiny details. We have to remember it's a communication design is. You need to know what that character's about the second they step on stage. It's an acting tool. So one thing we knew in the big general picture that we wanted to hand to the audience was a color wheel, was a spectrum, as Linda has said. And I'm just happy to be doing a comedy with some color because we do a lot of tragedy in the Phoenix. And it was just wonderful to get to come out and play. But the color is not exclusive to every single court in Twelfth Night. It's important to note that when we begin the play, a lot has already begun for Olivia. While Olivia is a mistress of her household and she's a very powerful woman, death has visited her door. And she is in mourning for her brother, and before that she was in mourning for her father. And so that does limit our color palette. We know that she would be in mourning attire. She's going to have to be in a black dress. And we also have a wonderful gag that Mr. Shakespeare has written for us to do with veils, that not only Olivia, but many of her gentlewomen and attending all have to have identical veils or similar veils to confuse somebody who is coming with a message. And then they say, oh, who is the lady of the house? I can't see anyone's face. I can't tell. So that is something that's provided in the play, and that limits the color. And then one of the discussions Linda and I had to have was, so who is going to be following in line and empathizing with Olivia? And that's a very director-designer moment, because I can suppose, you know, who would be Olivia's friend, who would be sympathetic to her, and would, of course, when you visit her, dress appropriately. But the director, of course, knows exactly what everyone's thinking. She's really in the heads of these characters. So we know that Mariah, who is Olivia's best friend, is definitely going to be a bit more in the grayscale as well, too, when she's visiting. And that Malvolio, his starting costume, he's absolutely appropriate. He would be in black. He would be dressed in a household of mourning. But he's also, he's the steward. And so in this time period, he's going to be our butler. So we needed a costume that would really portray the social mores of the time of propriety and a very official outfit. And I couldn't think of anything more appropriate. It was just jumping out that we need the bowler hat to come in. Absolutely. I mean, the bowler hat was a really a strange thing when it came on earlier in the century, but by 1960, it showed, you know, propriety. It was definitely part of the establishment. It was no longer sort of renegade.
Well, and maybe just to interject here, Kat, I should say, when we were talking about the setting, right, for the play, it was very clear that Illyria is England. It's very clear in the play. But Shakespeare takes that license of calling it Illyria. To me, it feels like Brighton, just south coast, and with lots of fog, right? So there is this thinly veiled sense that it really is England, but we're calling it Illyria. And there are lots of little touches, such as the bowler hat, such as the police officers, all kinds of other little things that tell you that we're really on the south coast of England. We won't say any more because I don't want to ruin some of the jokes. But anyway, that sort of ties into what Kat is saying about the bowler hat.
Absolutely. Yes, that does help to give us a place of time. And we do have British bobbies instead of a different sort of police uniform, which, again, gives you another visual. Oh, sorry. I'm away from this recorder, I'm guessing. So, oh, thank you, Linda. So we do have British bobbies and constables instead of regular police officers. It's another visual clue that we are in England, that we're in a thinly veiled disguise of Brighton by the sea. To just sort of address our color palette, we have a dark black in mourning household that begins in Olivia's, and then it comes alive. Love suddenly touches her heart. She meets who she thinks is the love of her life. It's, of course, a girl in disguise. It's Viola. She has no idea. She thinks it's a young man named Cesario, a swami of all things. He's very exotic and colorful. And so Olivia gets to don some color near the end of the play. We have this beautiful red chiffon dress for her, a nice full skirt to capture the time period. And this is also mimicked by what Malvolio will appear in later, that the household blossoms into color. And then Olivia's court starts to match with Orsino's. Now, Orsino's court has lots of color to begin with. However, it is entirely besieged by this Indian influence because he meets this one swami and a whole bunch of Hare Krishna and invites them in. And there's a meditation room. They're singing the Oms. They're lighting incense. They're having the time of their lives. And of course, if you've ever met a Hare Krishna, as I have, there's a very distinct color that they wear. It's that orange, right? And sometimes a little bit in the yellow. And that, of course, forces the designer's hand. If we know we're going to have a musical entourage of four or five people dressed entirely in orange, we need to find the rest of our rainbow somewhere else, don't we? Otherwise, it's just going to look like Halloween out there. So we have our Hare Krishnas. There's a couple of designs we've done for them. And yes, we have their telltale ponytail, and the little shaved one that they have at the back. Lots of fun. And our female flower child, Hare Krishna, a young British woman who no doubt has just recently joined and has just been introduced to this new philosophy and is just starting to tag along with them, one of their newer intakes. And then here we have the twins. We have Viola, who disguises herself as Cesario, and we have Sebastian. And we've already mentioned that one of the reasons we went with a swami so we can wrap up Viola's hair. When we see her earlier, she, of course, has it down. She's been in a shipwreck. And we got to make these entire costumes, of course. We do get to make quite a few costumes in this department. I don't want to give the impression that we're under such strains that we don't get to have some fun. But for the two main twins, of course, we had to do entire head-to-toe constructions out of linen and Dupione silk as well, too, and lots of variations on their costumes as well. And so these are all structured and tailored to, of course, give her a suit that will make her look a little bit more boyish, give her some shoulders, change her form. It's a real acting tool for her. And the last scene, she's able, because the turban is nice and loosely wrapped, to show us that she's a woman after all. Sebastian slowly acquires his swami look. It's a little bit of a joke in the show that he comes in, he's got sort of a cotton light shirt, the sort of thing that George Harrison started to wear after he did his visits. And then he goes by the Barrow dealer and he might pick up a Nehru suit jacket and might pick up a scarf and just start to transform very slowly. So by the time that the two twins meet each other and they finally are reconciled, thinking the other one died in the shipwreck, they're both in disguise. They're both completely different than they used to be. And there's that heightened comedy of, I think I recognize you, but you're a girl. And I think I recognize you, but what are you wearing? So there's that going on. We also have a double cast, I should mention, in this show with regards to Feste. Now, Feste is the singing role that Linda's talked about that was there to highlight one of Elizabeth's own singers and to incorporate them in the show. We have a male Feste playing this evening, Mr. Graham Nathan. We also have a female Feste, but you will get to see her costume tonight regardless.
She'll be singing tonight. It's Friday. And her parents are here, so I think she's singing tonight.
She's singing tonight.
Yes. So.
Split casting. Well, the good news is that this show, it gets to change and to move around. It has a bit of a lava lamp feel to it.
maybe just interject, Kat, and explain that. In the fourth year of our acting program, we often have kids who haven't had enough opportunities on the main stage, even though they've been in the program for 2 years. So in order to ensure that everybody got a really solid opportunity, I double cast two roles, the Festies and the Mariahs. So depending on what night you're seeing the show, there'll be one or the other of them. And this way, that entire fourth-year class between our production and Daniel McIver and David Ferry's production, Inside, which is coming up next, We have cast that entire class for their final semester, and we took care of getting them all roles last semester as well. So, and it's a big class. There are 14 of them. So we can't always choose a play that's going to give everybody a really solid role. Some of them have had smaller roles. So for some of them in this production, it's their first major role. They've done a lot of smaller work and a lot of studio work. But it's very essential that we give them this opportunity. So that's why we've doubled them, right? Which, after all, it's a school, so it's our job to make sure they get the work. Carry on.
But no matter who is playing Feste each night, because they are the embodiment of the music, they're the primary singer, they're the ones who bring all of the musical interludes and instigate the music in the show, a costume needs to have a movement, a drape, the appropriate fabric to feel like the music, as well as just portraying the character. So we moved away from a traditional clown. Feste is often portrayed as the fool. And in our production, regardless of who's playing, they're a much more sage and knowing character, who's actually quite astute and uses their music to clue everyone in to what they are observing, that they can see through a lot of the disguises and know what's going on. Our female Feste you'll see tonight is in this lovely green paisley print from head to toe, and it's a silk it's a chiffon banding, and it's also a silk and cotton blending to it, and it's a real flower girl dress. You know, it moves around. It's a dancing dress. It's got the long drapey sleeves. She's got the headband. She's got her beads and everything going on. So she very much moves like the music, and she twirls, and it's very important to know as a designer, what the blocking is going to be like, how people are going to move, and getting into rehearsal, because it is a moving sculpture. And by accenting certain aspects of the body, not only do we make the actors look their best, but we also heighten them and help portray a message. So I'm very, very happy with my work on Feste, and I hope you enjoy her very much as well, too. Because we are in a seaside town, and there is a constant reference to the sea, I mean, we begin in Orsino's court, but then after that we go immediately to the shores of a shipwreck, to the sea itself. And there's always a returning to this sea captain, there's always a returning to these sailors and policemen who are trotting along the beach in our show. So there are a lot of maritime uniforms that we're seeing in instigations. We have different sailors' looks at the beginning. We have our sea captain. We have Antonio, who rescues Sebastian as sort of a second-in-command on the ship. And he acquires, because he is in danger in the town, he acquires a disguise. He unfortunately was involved in a military raid a few years ago, and of course he's wanted in Illyria. And he goes, oh no, I'm in Illyria. I'm a wanted man here. I need to hide my face. I must disguise myself. And so of course he also kicks it with the Hare Krishna, and he gets a headband and all sorts of things going on there. We also have Orsino, and I've given you a couple of plates of him here. He's three down at the bottom, the end in the purple. Orsino has a very interesting emotional arc that we try to match with his costume. He begins by getting the worst news possible. He's in front of his entire court, and he's told that, you know, he's been dumped. He really can't be with this woman anymore, and you know, he's feeling sorry for himself, he's internalized on all of this, but he is determined, he's going to get her back, he's going to win Olivia over. And he befriends Cesario, he takes lots of advice from Cesario, and Cesario is of course Phyla, who's fawning after him. And he's changed by this relationship, this friendship, and he starts to actually feel things he never thought he'd feel for a man. But he suppresses them, he continues to go after Olivia. And only in the last scene, when, of course, the disguise is dropped, does he realize he has a perfect woman who's right there. It's always been there for him. So because of this, we wanted to show that he is influenced by the Swamis, more so than just inviting them to his court, but he starts to wear Indian apparel. He starts to chant and meditate and begins to do that sort of thing. So we began with a look that's sort of inspired by Patrick Litchfield, if any of you remember him. He was a great photographer of the time period. He used to throw wonderful soirees where he put on Regency coats and the big lace cuffs and he would drink brandy glasses. And it was very westernized, of course. It was all inspired by France and English wear. And as he befriends Cesario, and we see him in preceding scenes, he starts to wear loose cotton shirts with Indian necklines. He starts to put on silk brocaded vest. He starts to wear the long beads and meditation and prayer beads as well, too. And by the very end, he gets this long Nehru jacket, which is made entirely of shot silk. And that matches him in color and in presence and in cut with, of course, Cesario, who will be his match by the end. He has started to become very similar to Viola, and so they're equally matched by the end of the show. We also have one of my favorite little plates down here, Sir Andrew Aguecheek, who is one of the best fencers in the entire show. He's practiced fencing. He's an active man. Doesn't have a lot going on between his ears, necessarily. But he's really in his body. And so in this production, Linda and I said, well, what are we going to do about the fencing? 1970. Are we going to change it to, you know, to guns? No, that doesn't seem right. To knives? It's a bit scary. And Linda said, well, I think we can keep swords, but someone's got to be a fencer. Now, who would that be? And of course, we thought, Sir Andrew Aguecheek could be practicing in the background, or he could be coming back from his fencing practice. He's aristocratic, he's rich, he's got more money than sense. Of course, he's a fencer in this time period. When's it going to come in handy in 1970, right? And so we have this wonderful outfit for him where he comes in with the white tights and the sneakers, and he's got the mask and, of course, the gorget on his coat and everything. And he looks wonderful in contrast to all of this color to come in completely blank and receptive.
Maybe I could just interject here too, Kat. This character, Andrew Aguecheek, he's here to court Olivia, of course, at her cousin or uncle, Sir Toby's behest. And Toby's been milking Andrew, right? For a couple of thousand, he says, already. Leading Andrew on to think that he has a chance with Olivia. Now, Andrew's a dresser. And Kat has given him some of the best costumes in the show, actually. The very first time we see him, yes, he's in his fencing outfit, but you should see what he wears after that. Well, actually, he's at the party beforehand, and he's quite natty. But the interesting thing is there's a point where Andrew decides that he's leaving. He has seen Olivia throw herself at the Count's serving man, Cesario, in the garden. And he's really piqued, and he's going to leave. And that's when we discover the number of suitcases that Andrew brought with him as he came for his visit, including a golf caddy, which is full of swords and golf clubs and whatever else might be useful, which we then leave on the stage. And indeed, it does become useful, as you will see, when we get to the fight scenes. And we use more than swords in that scene. So that's as much as I'll tell you, because we don't want to give too much away.
Yes, he is rather a mixed character for costuming. And he's got, obviously doesn't have very natural taste himself, but he's been raised with a certain amount of it. So he has a wonderful tailored suit in one scene. In the next one, he'll have... You'll finally get to see the shirt that was underneath it, and it's the brightest yellow pattern possible, and it's really rather outrageous and probably a bit too much. But of course, he has no idea, and he thinks he looks fabulous.
And he also doesn't know that yellow is the color that Olivia can't stand.
And he's been wearing it almost the entire show when he finds out, so it gets him right there. We also have to find a couple of levels of difference in relationships between Mariah and Olivia, because they're both going to be in mourning attire. There's certain hemlines and coverages that they're going to have in common. But, of course, the lady of the house must always be the focus of the scene. We can't lose Olivia for Mariah. And then when Mariah's in her scenes with Sir Toby and Sir Andrew and Fabian, her black will serve her and she'll stand out. So we use this by giving a really dramatic veil and a very large brimmed hat for Olivia. And her black dress is made out of a satin. So while these drawings sort of show a slight difference between a gray and a black, it's actually the finish of the fabric that draws our eye to Olivia, and that she is just glistening in a watery, sort of shiny fabric as well, too. And it's a full skirt with two vents in the back, so it moves beautifully on stage.
It's stunning.
I'm very happy we got to make that dress. It was a wonderful opportunity as well, too. And it really gives a feel of the time as well, too. It's quite similar to a few of the dresses I was researching that Biba used to do in the late, late, late 60s, just before 1970. They started to sort of touch into this black semi-Victorian fashion. And this is the sort of thing, this fresh romantic appeal that Olivia would probably subscribe to. given her circumstances and her class as well, too. So that's a little taste sample of what we have going on here. And I don't know, do you want to talk about our process a bit, Linda?
Yeah, we can do. Are there any questions so far that we've piqued your curiosity about? Okay. Well, the process begins, as I said, with trying to serve the play first. And then, having found the parallel in the era, the 70s, Kat and I sat down and began to suss out each character and look at how we create a family. First in Orsino's court and then in Olivia's household, and how those worlds contrast as well as compare. So as Kat has laid out that process for you, Orsino, by the time Olivia, or by the time Viola's finished with him, has practically converted to a Swami himself. So one wonders about that marriage. But anyway, in Olivia's court, we moved out of mourning into full blazing color as she realizes she's fallen in love and she begins to court Cesario. So we see the contrast in these families and the effect that it has. We also have the journey of her brother Sebastian and his friend who has saved his life, Antonio. And that is the third journey wending its way through. And then we have the subplot of Sir Toby, Sir Andrew, and Mariah, and all the others coming in along with Malvolio. So those families all interconnect. So the director and the designer have to sit down first and work out a plot of how it's all going to come together and what the changes and transformations will become and what the final product will look like. For example, let's turn back to Malvolio for a moment. I said that he was the butt of the joke of that first Twelfth Night, modeled on a real person who had gotten out of line. And everybody at the court knew it and wanted to, well, sort of ridicule him back into conformity. He was also, from all that one can gather, not a particularly easy fellow and not very nice to anybody who was his subordinate. So again, he was the natural butt of the joke. So he starts out being the proper man, the keeper of the keys, the keeper of conformity in Olivia's world. And he ends up, because of Mariah's trick, picking up a letter that he thinks has been written by Olivia, because Mariah and Olivia's handwriting is very similar. He reads it, and he's convinced that his lady loves him. And he follows certain instructions, which then has him transform from being this very conservative, staid master of the household to being a sexual predator. And he is in his glory as he does this. So how we did that transformation, as I said, we're trying to hide from you a little bit so that we won't ruin the surprise. But indeed, we were looking at, of course, the people of the period who had that kind of sexy quality, and Mick Jagger immediately sprang to mind, as he would naturally do. So we were looking at costumes that he wore, and would you believe it, we hit on the very thing. So you can judge for yourself in terms of how successful we were with that. Because, of course, originally, the joke was that Malvolio would appear in yellow stockings. Now, by the time yellow stockings came along in 1600, they were old-fashioned in 1600. And Elizabeth was always at the height of fashion. So not only were they old-fashioned, They were a color she didn't like. And cross-gartering, which she's also requested to do, was also out of fashion at that time. So the but was that he would come dressed in a fashion that was completely out of vogue, right? When we translate that into the 70s, it is in fact what we ended up with, the height of something that is in vogue. In fact, a singer is on the stage wearing it at a rock concert, right? So there's the flip of that process for us to find a solution, because it's all about finding solutions. Not everything translates, of course, 100%, but I think the gel is pretty good, and you'll see the connections. Partly because the generation of the 70s and the generation of Elizabeth's court, particularly the end of the court, have a lot of parallels. There's a war, for example, on the periphery of Twelfth Night. And Elizabeth was always trying to keep war away from her country. But it's there. Just as in 1970, of course, there was a war going on in Vietnam, right? There were protests everywhere. And there was an enormous peace movement that was afoot, of which, and part of which, the Hare Krishna are connected, right? So you'll see that V sign, peace, peace, man, peace. And you'll hear that in and out through the play. So really, how well we succeeded in making this connection? Well, you'll see. But for our process, it really started, as I said, with looking at the play, looking at the characters, finding the parallels, and then saying, okay, we're dealing with aristocrats. They're not just wearing blue jeans. So they can wear anything. So what do we put them in? To, again, create the world they live in, which is pretty rarefied, and connected to something that is also familiar to all of you, and exciting to those who have come to it for the very first time. And the other happenstance, which is very great for us, is that if you haven't noticed, the 70s are back in fashion.
They absolutely are.
Which is absolutely terrific. Bell bottoms have come back. All kinds of looks are in that were very apropos. Even the paisleys and the tie-dyes have come back. And, of course, the maxi dress has come back, which we are also using in the play. So how lucky we were just to hit it where we could actually go into a shop and buy what we needed, which is really, really great when you're short of time in particular. And, of course, the color palette, which was very psychedelic, we've been able to find. And it's that psychedelic quality which I think you'll enjoy, especially in the opening scene, which is the big party that Orsino's throwing while he awaits word from Olivia. So everybody's there in that party expecting that he's going to have a positive answer. And of course, well, there begins the tale, if you like. Okay, yes?
How did you choose instruments for the music?
Well, we were very lucky insofar as we have the man who's just stepped in right on cue.
Hey, it's Jeff!
Mr. Jeff Kuchwald, who's our associate director and music director and composer. Welcome. And Jeff will tell you a little bit about the music and the instruments that we're using.
Good timing for your question. I was sort of hiding up in the back, wondering if we'd get to the music, which definitely permeates this entire production from top to bottom, and has been really a source of fun for us throughout because of the amount of breadth of style that 1970 allows, really, the era of music from 1965 to 1975 was one of the richest in our, I think, musical history outside of classical, the classical and Renaissance. So what we wanted to look for is a number of styles, which included jazz, which included funk, which included pop, which included rock, which included traditional maritime music, which all of which you would find in Brighton at that time. Whether it's a mandolin, a busker on the street playing mandolin or guitar and singing a sea shanty, or working on some Simon and Garfunkel, or the Beatles. It was all there and all very, very much a part of this production. Another instrument that we knew we needed to have was a sitar. And that music coming from India and the music of Krishna Das is also integrated into this production.
And guess where we found one? On Salt Spring Island.
The music that we composed, as you know, the song has four songs that Shakespeare wanted set to music, and that music has been set and reset numerous times. In fact, there are volumes of different settings for this music, with which we decided not to pay any heed. We nearly said, why don't we? And then we thought, no, let's go completely original. And so we set out, my partner and I, Leora, who we compose the music together, to create music like we did in Yerma that was accessible and singable by the students, because they're not professionals, so we need to create music that is easily accessible and yet is still reminiscent and stylistically true. So we sat and chatted about the songs and the scenes and say, okay, in this scene, what's the mood? What is the song that we is conveying? What is Festi trying to say? And that would lead us to a style. Linda would say, why don't you make this one a little more jazzy or a little more like Simon and Garfunkel? Or I might say that, because we have the tendency to read each other's mind. And that's how, so you'll hear Mistress Mine and Come Away Death and Hey Robin, Jolly Robin, which are the three songs that we wrote for the show, are uniquely different in style and lend to exactly what we're trying to accomplish in the scene and the mood. And one of the most well-known songs in this show is the last song, which we had in the play until one day I emailed Linda and thought, you know, I'm not really sure how well this song fits in our production. And then she emailed me back. I was just about to email you that, why don't we do something different for the last song, the Hey Nonny No and the Wind and the Rain. And it's part of the ending that I had struggled with, and it's something that the play needs to be wrapped up, and that's a theme of love, and there's a song that just leapt right out as the obvious choice.
And we both thought of it at the same time.
And
it's great.
And so I hope you enjoy that.
And I hope you sing along.
And we hope you sing along.
Because you will know the song.
And you can also pay attention to what's happening in the. How did we choose the instruments? Well, the next logical choice is guitar, and of course the real logic to that in 1970 was everybody was plugging in, right? And amplification was key. So I managed to get the amplified electric guitar into the show, and it accompanies throughout. So follow along musically to some of the jokes and some of the things that I've set out there for you all to enjoy. What exactly is the tune he's playing, and how does that fit into the scene? Is all part of the fabric of the show that is unspoken, but it's all there for you. So I hope you enjoy the music.
Is there one more question before we... I need to pack you all off to the next theater where we're actually doing the play. Any other question? Yes? Well, then, thank you very much. I hope that helps you.
you.